Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Today, we are pleased on the HR Power Hour to have a four-part series with in-depth interviews of the four gubernatorial candidates of the great state of Maine. These interviews have been designed to be a positive conversation with the candidates, where we focus on real issues and concerns that business leaders, HR professionals, and employees care about today. I have some questions that I have created, but I have also asked some business leaders and show listeners their thoughts and built questions. After this interview, I will interview the additional candidates and I will ask them the basic questions. They may or may not get follow-up questions based on their answers, and not all questions may be asked of each candidate based on answers or time. Please note the views, opinions, and conclusions expressed by the candidates on this show are those of the candidate and not necessarily those of the HR Power Hour radio show, its ownership, sponsors, or Atlantic Coast Radio. The content of this show has not been approved, and each candidate is solely responsible for his or her content. Their appearance does not constitute an endorsement. Today, I'm David Chulo, your host of the HR Power Hour, and it's my pleasure to be speaking with Sean Moody, who is running for governor as Republican candidate for the great state of Maine. According to his website, seanmoody.com, Sean is best known as a businessman, a successful job creator, and he knows Maine's success for years to come is grounded in continuing to grow our economy, create jobs, improve wages for all people all over the state. He's graciously taken some time today out of his busy schedule to be with us today, and I'm truly excited to talk with him about his vision for the next 4 years. So let's get started. Welcome, Sean.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for having me, and I appreciate your flexibility. I know we've been a little hard to pin down lately.
No worries.
Thanks for being here.
Well, you said you'd come back if you won the primary. You did. You're back. See,
that's right.
It's a good thing you kept your word. All right, so a couple specific questions. Easy stuff to start off, right? Then we'll get into the hard stuff.
Sure.
What's the personal reason you're running for governor?
I think, I look at Maine. Maine's just a great state. I love the state of Maine. You know, I've lived here. My wife, we've raised our kids right in the hometown of Gorham. We started a business in Gorham, grown it to, you know, across the state, 11 locations, close to 200 coworker owners. You know, our company is 34% owned by the coworkers. And I just see the opportunities that Maine has, especially for our younger population, that next generation. And I just feel compelled. It's like, look, we can't be the first generation to leave Maine, you know, in a worse place than when we found it. And I really feel like we're, you know, the current administration, Governor LePage, has done an excellent job in getting a fiscal house in order. He inherited $750 million in hospital debt, a $1.3 billion pension crisis. Unemployment was close to double digits here in the state. So we've made tremendous progress over the last 8 years, and I feel like the governor's got a really good fiscal foundation. Now it's time to build something really special on it.
You know, you have a background as a businessman. We kind of talked about it in the introduction, somebody who knows how to create jobs. Tell me how you feel it's going to be in terms of your qualifications to run a much bigger role, the state of Maine as CEO.
Well, this is interesting, Dave, because it hasn't really, I don't think it's been unmasked well by the media, and I'm not expecting them to do that. But I'm the only candidate in the race that has a proven track record of success in the private sector of actually starting a business, growing a business, employing people, creating good paying jobs, training and development. But at the same time, I've served on the university system and the community college boards of trustees. No one in the state's history had ever served on both. And I get on there 4 years ago. USM was upside down. Community college, the president stepped down. You know, so both systems were in turmoil. We brought those two systems together so you can transfer credits now seamlessly across the systems. USM had a $16 million budget deficit. Now we just put $8 million back in the budget stabilization fund. Enrollment is increasing. They just announced that overall system-wide enrollment is increasing in a declining environment. So we put in some of those business practices that we know how to market. We know how to, you know, sales and marketing manage and organizational effectiveness. We took out $80 million and back office administrative overhead out of the University Main system. That's what I want to do in pre-K through 12. There's so much administrative overhead in our pre-K through 12 education system that isn't going into the classroom. So we need to pay our teachers more. We need to be able to them to buy their own classroom supplies. And there's $2 billion being spent on education. There's no reason in the world why the good teachers shouldn't get paid more, and we should resource them adequately. So private sector experience, but the public sector experience, it doesn't get talked about much. The two combined budgets of those systems are close to $750 million to manage both of those budgets. And another key component is serving on the investment committee, the finance and facilities and technology committee, the executive committee, the human resource labor relations committee. So basically negotiating contracts with labor units across the board. So when you look at me and say, oh, I was a business guy. Oh, wait a minute. I've been public servant for the state of Maine and its people for the last 4 years, not a paid position, no free insurance. I don't even take mileage reimbursement. I do it because I want to give back to the state of Maine. And you look at where these systems are today and where they were when I joined those two boards, I think it's a proven track record of success.
You're listening to the special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show here on WLOB. I'm your host, David Chulo. We're talking with gubernatorial candidate Sean Moody, who's running for governor for the state of Maine. Sean, I think it's fair to say you even mentioned in the last segment there that Maine's economy has certainly improved. There's no question. With unemployment at 2.7%, job growth has been strong. Even with the job growth, of course, there is this challenge in regards to getting people to come into the state of Maine, getting people to stay in the state of Maine. We talk about vacation land, right? Some, that's the old line. I know we're open for business now. But vacation land, people come for the vacations. They don't necessarily stay and work. And they don't, because there is a challenge in regards to the state's economy of keeping people here from a cost perspective, right? Cost versus income. Right. We've talked offline. I'll say it again just so the audience understands. If you're looking at the Portland market specifically, our highest growth market, no question, right? That market, from a cost perspective, is very similar to outside of the Boston market, right? Suburbs of Boston. Yet the income level is certainly maybe half, maybe two-thirds of what that is. So when we, as people, try to hire, I'm a business owner, right? I have two businesses. Right. When I try to hire and bring it in, I try to bring people to the state. It is a challenge to get them to understand, hey, come on into the state. It's going to cost you the same, but you're going to get less. Explain how you as governor, how your administration could deal with this issue. You're right, we've put our fiscal house in order. How do we fix this issue?
Well, I think it all starts in our, again, education system. You know, our guidance counselors, our teachers, even our parents have had this message about Maine for the last decade. There's no opportunity here. And so the kids listen to them. They get their education and they leave in search of opportunity, not limited to Boston, obviously, but other areas, highly populated areas and growth areas in the country. Here's what we need to look at. When you're young, and I tell people this, you got to pay less attention to what you earn and more attention to what you learn. So if you're going to go to work for a best-in-class company with room for upward mobility, you might not get as much as you would in a occupation that's just going to, it's going to be this. If you did it 1 week, you could do it the rest of your life. It isn't going to change. So we need to message our young adults and let them know that right now in Maine, there's never been a period in our history where there's more upward mobility than right now because we have an aging state. So use that aging demographic to your advantage as a young person that has the skills, has the education, has some drive to come here. And you could be, a town manager. It doesn't matter if you're in public policy, if you're in business, if you're in education, all of these leaders are going to be retiring out in the next 2 to 5 years. So the opportunities are wide open here in Maine. We don't do a good job messaging that and letting our young folks know their options and opportunities. So I don't see this demographic cliff as a perfect storm. If I'm a young person, I see it as a perfect opportunity. And especially in our rural areas of our state, you can be a big fish in a little pond. And the other thing we're going to do, two things, Dave, are important. We are going to go out and strategically market those Mainers that have left. Like you said, 7 or 8 years ago, double-digit unemployment. They had to leave to get their life going. Now we reach out. They're raising their families. They don't want the kids to be walking through metal detectors at school. They see where they're at, Houston, Texas, or Miami, Florida. They don't want to raise their families there. So we do reach out to them with a strategic marketing plan and ask them to come home. Now, they're going to bring talent. They're going to bring some assets. They're going to bring their families. They're young. They're healthy. It's exactly what we need to grow Maine's, continue to grow Maine's economy sustainably. And people ask me about renewable energy. I said, that's the biggest renewable energy project we need to take on, is bringing our youth back here and revitalize, especially our rural communities across the state. So the other thing, that's the immigration of former Mainers. 30 million people, as you mentioned, Dave, come here to enjoy our state. They save up all year long to come here for a week, two.
That's right.
And they love Maine. So guess what? Let's make Maine, instead of vacation land, also staycation land. Staycation land. Again, messaging, marketing. You know, we have them right here. You know, I don't think it's a heavy lift to hang on to 15 to 20,000 of them, you know, to spread across our state, to again, to revitalize and continue this economic growth. The reason our GDP lags somewhat in New England or across the country is just because of our population. It really is. And the healthcare costs going up. The root cause of all that is we haven't paid attention to our feeder system. So everyone out there understands, whether you follow sports or in business, any organization to have continued success needs a good feeder system. And that's what we need to focus on. That's why I'm so passionate about education.
What are the three things economically that you plan to do different than the current administration?
Well, I think we need to continue to lower our income tax down. I mean, the current administration, Governor LePage, brought it down from 8.5% to 7.15%. That's a huge success. We need to continue to lower that. I'd like to see a realistic goal of 5% in our first administration, the first term. And how do we get there? You know, where's that money come from to provide those savings? We've got economic growth right now. We just had the two highest tax revenue months that we've had in the state's history. But what happens in politics? You know, all the politicians are lining up at the trough and go, oh man, we got to get our hands on that money. No, we have to reduce government spending and waste in a way that's meaningful. And at the same time, let our economy grow and provide more tax revenue, tax dollars. We can use those dollars to lower a tax rate, which advances and encourages more growth, and get that momentum going that's going to carry us into the next decade. It's not going to be done by taxing people and spending. That's why I vote no on one, you know, that 3.8% surcharge tax, that it's going to tax our professional community, working families. You know, you get two people, professional people working, and small businesses. Again, backbone of the state. Our backs are getting tired out there, folks. You know, I mean, small business is not the enemy. You know, we're the horse that's pulling the cart.
Well, you know, you're absolutely correct. 80% of the state is family businesses, right?
That's right.
And those
are
very small family businesses, and there are large ones, don't get me wrong, but from an economic standpoint, 80% of the state is family businesses. Family business is a different animal compared to a corporation. Now, don't get me wrong, some family businesses are corporations, but the structure is different, the uniqueness of it. That gives Maine a unique niche.
Exactly right. And I'm so glad you brought that up, Dave. That coalition of businesses represent over half Maine's workforce. Over half. And here's what these barriers we're going to break down. They can't buy experience-rated or group health insurance. So you wonder why we have all these uninsured people out there. Well, the small businesses don't generate enough revenue to be able to provide those types of benefits. So let them join an association. Let them join a co-op of 5,000 people. Let's say you're a florist, for example. Join the National Florist Association, and you can buy health insurance with 5,000 members. That's some horsepower. Now you can buy it at a price that's affordable, so you can split it with your coworker or whatever. So we don't just keep going back to the government to try to cover our cost. Private enterprise will do that if we create competition in the marketplace we don't have right now. So let's get back to capitalism instead of government control. That's what I offer the voters. You know, we can do this. We can solve a lot of our problems, but government is part of the problem. It's not the solution. That if you want someone who's been in government 30, 40 years and you really think that they've got the answers, say, well, why didn't you fix it? You've been up there 30 years. Why didn't you fix these things?
It's a great question.
You know, we fix things in our plan. Our health insurance premiums in our small business would have crested $1 million last year. We went self-insured. We've lowered our health care costs by 20% by doing that. Now, why can't small businesses do things like that? They're being blocked out by the big companies because the insurance companies don't want competition. It's that simple. And America was built on capitalism and competition. And when you take that out of the market, you get higher prices and a lower quality service.
We'll talk a little bit more about education for a minute. Training in technology skills today has really been a need, right? Technology is a huge area of challenge in manufacturing. You know, technology continues to be the driving force behind manufacturing, driving force behind everything. I mean, let's be honest, technology is where it is today. There are a lot of skilled workers that don't have that technology skill today. How do we deal with that issue and help them move along?
It's, Dave, these are really great questions. I am convinced, okay, this is what's happened. Our trades programs, okay, our vocational and career tech ed programs are being run by white-collar administrators. Think about that. They don't know what they don't know. So we need to reform those systems, those programs, to be the best in the country. How do we do that? We take the instructors that we currently have, and we ask them to work 2 weeks a year at a best-in-class business in their respective field. So in other words, if they're in doing the collision repair program, they'd have to come to, you know, Moody's, they'll say, for a week and spend a whole week so that we can basically get them up to speed on what the current technology is, the equipment that's out there, the products, the processes, so they can know what's going on real time in their respective industry. They get in the classroom, they get isolated, and industry is not engaged at a high enough level so that we can provide the results, because we know what we need in our workforce, depending on what industry, whether if it's welding, you know, electrical, HVAC, pick the trades. So it's not the students, it's the curriculum and the instruction. It's not the instructors even. It's the curriculum and the equipment that they have. It's outdated. And we're not going to get them up to speed unless they have somebody like me, who's a blue-collar guy that understands that he's a tradesperson, a master craftsman. And that's the number one. If you think about our drug problem and kids that are out there working for minimum wage, $10 or $12 an hour, there's no need of that. We should be ashamed of ourselves, what we've let happen in our education system. We should be ashamed of ourselves. It's embarrassing because these kids have the same drive, they have the same spirit that we did, but we're not providing them the pathways, the opportunities, and the training to provide those skills, as you mentioned, Dave. And it's just a matter of partnering with industry, which I will do because I got the blue collar and the white collar background.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with Sean Moody, who's running for governor for the great state of Maine. You mentioned question one. It's certainly a hot button issue, and I'll read it. It says, do you want to create the universal home care program to provide home-based assistance to people with disabilities and senior citizens, regardless of income, funded by a new 3.8% tax on individuals and families with Maine wage and adjusted gross income above the amount subject to Social Security taxes, which is $128,400 in 2018? I already know you don't support it. No question. Well, here's what I ask. Why should Mainers, it sounds good, vote no?
There's several reasons. The first, I think, and the most important one is we need to reform our citizen referendum process. This is a great example of that. You're reading a paragraph, and there are literally pages and pages. I think I went to a session the other day. It was 13 pages behind this referendum of details and facts and structure that no voter is going to have access to. So when you circumvent the legislature, you know, the public hearings, the vetting, you have committee hearings, you have a fiscal note attached, what's this going to cost the taxpayers? I think it's over $300 million. Those are the things that are absent in these referendums. And I think that's what's driving so much contention and division amongst up at the State House. I really do. We need to reform that process so all of Maine is represented, not just the heavy populated areas like Portland, for example. Okay, with that, now the specific referendum question. This would basically hit every successful small business in the state of Maine. They don't mention business on there, but our business income as an S-Corp or a limited liability company or a limited liability partnership all flow through to my wife and I's personal tax return. So yeah, you know, $200,000 is a lot of money for a couple here in Maine. But if you're running an enterprise where the payroll is $200,000 a week, $200,000 is nothing. You couldn't stay open for a week without that type of income. So again, we're punishing success. We're punishing the business community. We're punishing professionals. Here we are. We just got done talking about attracting young talent to the state of Maine. We're not going to do it by taxing them to death. They're not going to come. So this would be an incredible barrier to what our vision is and what we need to do and prioritize in the state of Maine with a young population growth to come back to Maine. The other important component to this that's not really detailed is you have to basically join a union in order to participate in the caregiving space. So here we are, you know, and there's no qualifications. So literally somebody could be, you know, like a millionaire in their home and say, hey, I'd like to have a little extra help around here and get free home health care regardless of their income level. That's crazy. You know, think about that. So again, I don't know the motive of trying to push this through onto the Maine taxpayers and the Maine citizens, but it's eerily similar of the funding for education. It's eerily similar of, you know, coming after our election system with ranked choice voting. I think it's the same, you know, money, outside money and groups that are forwarding this. And I would just say to the Maine voters out there, do your homework. Do your homework. Bill Diamond's got a great video out, you know, ad on TV. And I applaud Bill. He's a great guy. And it really, you know, looks in the camera and says, do your homework. The more you find out about this, the more you realize this is not good for Maine.
You talked a little bit about the referendum process, right? And I've said for years that I think it's broken, because the reality is I think you shouldn't be able to stand in the middle of Monument Square, downtown Portland, get all your signatures in about 3 or 4 days, and it goes on the ballot. It really should be a representation, in my opinion, of the entire state. And whether that's by county or whether that's by district or whether that's by whatever it is, representation of that. What's your plan or what's your thought process in regards to that, and how would you propose to solve that problem?
Well, I think that we need to educate the legislators to how critical it is. And again, the sword cuts both ways. I mean, this may be an advantage to one party in this cycle, but you got to look at it with open eyes. This could be a real disadvantage to the other party in the next cycle. So I think that there's an attitude up there that recognizes now this slippery slope we've gone down. So I'm confident that we could work with the legislature. And you had a great idea. You're right, Dave. Let's do it by district. I think county, someone said that may not be. But anyway, we need to introduce legislation that we get full representation of the whole state, our rural areas of our state. And as importantly, we need to make sure that these have public hearings and that they're vetted for what the tax or economic impacts are going to be if it's a tax-related question. That those are critical. Is it constitutional? Right? Like ranked choice voting. People ask me all the time, you know, what are we going to do with this ranked choice voting, Sean? It's like, well, it doesn't affect the governor's race. They don't know. They're confused. That's not what we want. I mean, we don't want to confuse people any more than they already are. It's tough enough living life as it is with all these stupid, complex things coming at us. So we need to simplify it, make it more straightforward, more transparent. And that's what Mainers want. They want to know what they're voting on. And when I was at the polling districts on primary day, I was in Windham, Gorham, Buxton, and Scarborough. I mean, those are four pretty heavily, you know, robust areas on voters. And more people came over to me because I'm well-known, you know, it's my backyard. And they were just so angry and so upset that they didn't even know. So I hope I voted right on that ranked choice. I don't know if I did. And it's pretty sad when you have to rely on, like, road signs to know how to vote on an issue.
You know, minimum wage is the issue that employers are dealing with right here in the state. As you know, it's going to go up every year. Keeps going, right? And then after it keeps going up, we then have it's going to index thereafter. Is there a priority in your administration to try to fix that, number one? And number two, just a side note on that, you now see cities and towns raising their own minimum wage. Portland and others are talking about it. Is it a good idea to have individual minimum wages within each little town or city? What's your thoughts on all that?
Well, I honestly think that here's a good example where politics went sideways on us. And let's back up here a little bit. The minimum wage was like $7.65 an hour, and it wasn't that long ago, and hadn't been changed or increased in years and years. And wage growth is a huge problem, has been. And it's just finally now starting to see wage growth, which is critical to all the working families here in Maine and working individuals. So the Republicans didn't want to bend on that, didn't want to go anywhere. And the Democratic Party wanted to go to the other extreme in Portland. They wanted to double it. Well, that failed. Even in Portland, that failed. But what it did is set the tone and the agenda to say, well, let's raise it. So then they came up with this plan that went, you know, to 10, then 11, then 12, and then hook it to indexing, which to me is too aggressive, is too much, too quick. However, the Republicans didn't want to budge to move it at all. So then when the Democrats knew they had the, you know, the little momentum behind them, they said, hey, heck with you. You don't want to work with us. We're not working with you. So I think that's where politics gets in the way of what's best for the main people. Because I can tell you right now, I've traveled the whole state, this minimum wage increase is just punishing rural small business owners, just punishing them. They've had to let people go. They're working more hours themselves. They've had to close days, you know, because they don't have help. It's had that unintended consequence of really had a ripple effect in our rural areas of our state that it really impacts them dramatically. I'll give you an example. I know a guy has a grocery store up there, and he said it's costing about, I think it was $32,000 more to absorb those minimum wage. That's a small business owner in a rural community. The grocery store is pretty much the heartbeat of your local community.
It sure is.
And he was just devastated. He said, the problem, Sean, and what it does, it blocks out the next generation workforce, the people I was talking about earlier. So I would offer, in the short term, tax credits to employers to hire teenagers that are in school and give them a tax benefit to do that, because they're not going to pay a greenhorn, you know, someone with no experience, $12 an hour. They'll pay, you know, or hire someone with experience to work the hours. They just can't, economically, it doesn't work. So offer the tax incentive for employers. We have to get our teenagers back in our local community.
Do you think a training wage or an internship wage or something like that? I know that's apprenticeship wage.
Yeah, exactly, Dave. That's exactly right. But we need, again, it's my mind just automatically think, problem solve. I've done it for 40 years. So when I look at the problem and say, okay, employers need help. We've got students sitting on the couch at 2:30 in the afternoon playing with their iPads. Where are they going in life? So why? Are you serious? That's an easy fix, isn't it? We need to stimulate, give an incentive, get these teenagers to work. Now all of a sudden you got some role models in the community. Someone's got a couple bucks in their pocket, right? And maybe they buy a jacked up truck or something. And then they go, man, hey, are they hiring? I'd like to get a job too. That's how you start it. And we need it to happen now.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly Flagg, General Manager of the Body Architect Fitness Center in Portland, Maine. I want to personally invite you to come meet us. If you've been considering joining a gym but haven't yet because you're a little nervous or just plain old don't like the gym, come see us. We have created a 30-day personal training experience just for you. Meet our trainers, try a few workouts, and use our facility for 30 days for just $79. Call 774-2196 or visit thebodyarchitect.com today.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, you're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're speaking with gubernatorial candidate Sean Moody, who's running for governor here in the state of Maine. Are you enjoying this, Sean?
Well, you know, I'm a business guy, Dev. You know me. I mean, I'm not the type that needs to be like the center of attention, or you know what I mean? So it does put you in a, in me anyway, in a spot where, but you know, it's what we need to do to get elected, you know? So I will just say this, campaigning, you know, I'm not that, like, that's probably not something that I would typically do, but running an organization, running the state, that's what I'm excited about. I'm really excited about getting that job and taking Maine to the next level.
Well, speaking about that job, here's a crisis that we've talked about now for many years and is affecting employers, employees, and certainly families, and that's the opioid crisis. Mm. Employers are very concerned, obviously, in regards to how it's affecting the workforce. What are some of the things you're looking to deal with this serious issue?
Yeah, it is, Dave. No question. Sobering topic. It's had a devastating effect on our families, you know, our communities. There's nobody out there that's listening right now that can't think quickly of how it's impacted them. You know, it hits us all. So I think from an employer, employment community, looking at it through that perspective, we've got to resource enforcement correctly. You know, these are gangs. These are criminal organizations. They're targeting our most vulnerable. They know who they are. This isn't a happenstance, you know, like someone selling a little bit to satisfy their habit. These are criminal organizations. So we need to resource the MDEA and local law enforcement adequately to do their jobs. Another important component is the treatment aspect of this. And here's what I would ask. I've been to Milestone Recovery, Portland Recovery, Macaulay House, which is for substance use women with their children. It's an incredible program. Maine Health has a great program down in Biddeford. And I asked all of them, ENSO is the private provider. I asked all of them. I said, look, we have resources going into this critical area. What I would ask as governor would be the aggregator of this information. Come up with a dashboard, not less than 5 and not more than 10 matrix that you want to measure. Respect, you agree on what those are going to be. And then we'll publish those publicly quarterly. So we can see which one of these, you know, these centers is excelling in all the respective areas, whether it's, you know, how many people are relapsing, how many people they've had in treatment, in recovery, and how many people are employed. So when you look at that globally, now you can see and clearly understand what recovery centers are being successful in what areas, share those best practices, and we can accelerate improvement, a continuous improvement across the landscape. You know, cross-pollinate those best practices. Now we can say, okay, we need a recovery center in Washington County, which they do. Now we've got a model in place that we know works. It's got proven track record of success. So we resource that. It's like starting all over again. We can't afford. That's the problem with government. They just want to throw it against the wall and hope it sticks. This is the 21st century. We don't do that. We have 11 locations. If the refinish department's got something better going on in Lewiston, we spread that across all the locations so we can all benefit from it. So having a dashboard across all the government programs, but this is just specific to the recovery community, is going to be critical. So treatment is an incredibly important component. I'm a big advocate of sober houses. I mean, a lot of this can be done with private money. You know, you can buy a 4-unit or a 6-unit apartment complex, turn it into a sober house, give discounted rates to the people there, have a good person that's going to run that program and run that house. And that owner, that property owner, is building equity. So they don't have to make a lot of money on the cash flow side. They're building equity over time. They'll pay for it in 25 years, whatever it is. So, and these are people that want to help. They have some money, right, and they want to help. So let's turn to the private enterprise community, stand up these sober houses in our communities, and they've already proven to have a great deal of success because you've got to be sober to be there. And 3 things I would say to the folks out there for success is stability, because the mental health right situation is wrapped into all this, sobriety, and a job. Those are the 3 legs under your stool. And if you don't have one of those legs, you're not going to be steady. You're going to topple and go into relapse. The last one, which is still as important, have those folks that are in recovery that have seen their life just go right down that dark black hole, losing their family, losing their job, losing everything. And now they've started to rebuild their life through that pathway of sobriety and employment. Have them go into the middle schools. And I think that's a critical age, the middle schools. Get in front of those students. Connect with them. That's what people connect with people. They're not going to look at flyers and handouts and PowerPoint presentations. You get a real live person that will break down in front of them and say, I lost everything. I lost everything, and it happened in 6 months. It can happen to you. Stay away. Stay away from it. And if you know if your friends are into it, squeal on them. Go tell a school resource officer. Go tell a principal. Go tell someone that will listen. So I think education, again, if we're going to really eradicate this, that's what we need to go at it. If we're going to eradicate it, not just keep up with it. I think those are the three most important initiatives that we need to launch.
So employers, speaking about drugs, employers are dealing with the recreational use of marijuana now. And, you know, there's this stuff that's come out of the legislature. There's, you know, initiatives by the Department of Labor in regards to under the influence and techniques and this trainings. All that's fine. But employers do talk about the fact that people get treated differently. If you come into work drunk, if you come into work hammered, drunk,
yeah,
you are probably going to get fired.
Yeah.
In most cases, most companies have policies that say, okay, you're done. Or you may go into rehab, one of the two, depending on the situation. But most of the time, you can fire somebody for coming to work drunk. Under the current legislation, it's very hard to fire somebody if they come in stoned. Why should and how would you deal with the fact that there seems to be this discrepancy between just because it's a different drug?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. I think most people know my background. I was not supportive of that referendum. And again, it's just misrepresented. You know, they said, we want to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Well, they decriminalized the use of marijuana decades ago. I mean, up to small quantities. So that's a little disingenuous to say it wasn't legal before. You know, I mean, it's not, the jails aren't full of marijuana users like they led you to believe. What we really voted on was the full-blown commercialization of marijuana. So if they had worded it correctly and not been disingenuous and deceitful, that probably could have had a different outcome. However, it's the law. It's I, as governor, am going to uphold the law, whether I agree with it or not. It doesn't matter. And so I'm going to be very careful to make sure that through that rulemaking process that we've got to sort some of these things out, Dave, because you're right, the employers are exposed big time. Big time. You know, if you let someone go, as you described, you know this is what the world you live in. You're very good at it. You let someone go, and they go hire an attorney and say, I was wrongfully terminated. I wasn't high. You can't prove it. I mean, you're not going to win that settlement. So I believe personally that what we need to do is we have to have a clinically proven way to test for it. I mean, that hasn't evolved yet. It's got to evolve here. I'm sure there's so many people in the country that are working on that right now as we speak. That just needs to happen. And I'll give you my background. When I first started in business, I built a car carrier. So I'd go out and do police calls. You know, so I'd be up all hours of the night. This is back in the 70s and early 80s. And drunk driving was prevalent back then. No seatbelt law. So I literally, 2 o'clock in the morning, go to the accident scene. That was before they had jaws of life. So I'd help the firefighters and the responders pull people out of the cars, you know, winch the doors open. And I saw the tragedy and the carnage around drunk driving and automobile accidents. It was devastating. Seeing people draw their last breath. I tell you, that doesn't leave you, you know, that impact. And we've done so much to really address drunk driving, lowering the alcohol limit. We've done a great job in protecting people and keeping them safe on the highways and on the roads. So I have, and again, you think about it, this industry is going to help our private business because it's going to create more automobile accidents. But I've been out front saying that I was, so I don't put my business income interest over what I think is best for the people of Maine. So we need to make sure that the rulemaking is done thoughtfully and deliberately so we keep the exposure to marijuana away from our kids, our teenagers, God forbid. And we need to make sure that our employers have, you know, some protection against these, you know, frivolous lawsuits and unlawful terminations and things like that. And we'll get there. But it's a law that's on the books, and we've got to find the rulemaking way to put it in play.
You're listening to a special edition of the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, David Chulo. We're speaking with Sean Moody, who's running for governor for the great state of Maine. We talked a little bit in the first segment about health care, and health care is a huge cost for employers. You talked about the situation with the 11 Moody Collision Centers, right, and the costs. They're going up again. There's no question. Matter of fact, I know for our organization, we're just getting our rates this week.
What did they go up, Dave?
13%.
Wow.
13%.
And that's been typical, hasn't it?
That has been typical across the platform. So, you know, this is a real issue, and it is a bottom line cost.
That's right.
It's essential to have it for the employees. Hell, it's essential to have it for me and my family. Yeah. How do we deal with this issue of the continued cost increases?
The only way we can effectively and sustainably deal with it, I'm convinced. And you're talking, I'm talking as a person that started from scratch, so had just two people with health care coverage, rise up to the 50 coworker threshold, which is where you can start buying experience rated plans. See,
right.
most employers would never know what that even is. Now all of a sudden, it opens up a whole world of information. You look at all your costs related to who's going to the emergency room. When I say who, it's not like they don't name people. You have the Pfizer rules, but the population. So say 70% of your worker population is using the emergency rooms. You know, and you've got a list of what pharmaceutical or medications that they're on. So you can see you've got a problem there if you have mental health issues going on in your company and how to address those or recognize that you can do some work on it. So it allows you to actively participate in keeping your coworkers well, which helps them become more productive. You know, so it's a win-win for the employer and the coworkers. Small employers, as you described, 80% of Maine's companies, businesses are blocked out of that data or that information. They don't have any idea what's going on, you know, other than they know because they work with folks if they get sick.
Right, you're right.
Oh, they don't know the costs associated with it. So this is the answer. We have to allow our small employer population to buy through co-ops and associations where they have the power, the buying power of a major corporation. Now, all of a sudden, now they're looking at a 13% decrease, right, Dave? Instead of a 13% increase, which would incentivize the employer to say, hey, you know what? Instead of covering, you know, half the cost, I'm gonna cover three quarters of the cost. Now, why would an employer do that? Because they need help and they need to hang on to help. How do you attract and hang on to help? You offer good benefits. That's simple.
Right.
So the employers want to participate. We just have to remove the barriers and allow them to. I mean, you've got two, maybe three dominant insurance companies here in the state of Maine. Imagine if you only had three collision repairers, three radio stations, you know, three anything. You're going to pay through the nose. I mean, that's just goes without saying. It almost creates a monopoly.
Well, there's no question. You can go across the border in New Hampshire, and it's, you know, I've actually shopped in New Hampshire as if I was to move my organization from Maine to New Hampshire. I did the analysis. This was, in fairness, 2 years ago. And I said if I moved the company from Maine to New Hampshire, the healthcare cost drops 43%.
See, there you go. I mean, that's factual. You're speaking of somebody that actually did the due diligence, and that's just talking fact right there,
yeah.
Dave. So I would just say to all the people out there listening, and it's getting hit with these increases at work, or no, you're not covered at all. Folks, we can fix this. We can accomplish this, but we have to get the politics out of the way. Because that's the lobbyist up in Augusta. That's where the trains go off the track. We're all busy working and leading our lives. And up at the State House, there's a lot of activity that none of us know what's going on. And believe me, regulation doesn't necessarily not benefit certain corporations. Sometimes they're the ones writing the regulations to block out the little guys, the small employers or whatever.
Sure.
So I would just pledge to everyone out there listening, is nobody's laid in bed any more than I have at night wondering, okay, how are we going to reduce cost? How are we going to do it better? How are we going to do it faster? That's just in my DNA. We have to apply the same business skills and acumen to state government. And that will help every single person out there in the state of Maine because we're lowering our cost. You know, an old fella told me years ago, it's not what you take in, it's what you hang on to. And it's hard for Mainers to hang on to any money today because the property tax is going up.
That's right.
Healthcare costs going up. Groceries. I mean, everything's going up faster than wages.
So I'm going to do kind of a little rapid test for you here.
Sure.
All right. I'm going to talk about four quick things. There are laws in other states that have either been proposed or being thinking of proposed here in Maine regarding employers. All right. So let's go with the first one. Equal pay law. if you're not familiar with it, if you are, prohibits employers from paying a lower rate than paid to employees of a different gender for comparable work, or may include rate parity for job titles or experience. Don't like it, do like it.
I think, you know, we have really, really tough and really fair discrimination laws on the books right now in the state of Maine that cover how people are treated, you know, and how they're paid. And I think that, again, in a full employment environment, that there's no advantages, no way that employers are going to start discriminating against people. They need people worse than ever before. So, yeah, I'm all for equal pay, equal how you treat people. But I don't know, as government should always, you know, there's a moral aspect to this question. I think that good employers treat people right. They treat them fair. And that's how they grow their business. It's a core value.
Mandatory paid sick law. It requires employers to pay employees part-time or full-time mandatory paid sick.
Yeah, again, you know, we're talking a lot about government intervention in business. And, I you know, I'd say to the people that try to advance those things, government can't run their own business. And those of us that run good businesses resent the fact that government wants to run our business.
How about a salary history law? This is in Massachusetts, for example. Employers cannot ask a applicant during screening what their salary is, what their pay history is. They can't even ask for it on the application.
I don't know that that's even... I guess you can ask, but they don't have to volunteer that information. You know, you can't force them to tell you what they're making or any of those things. I think that's a negotiation part of an employer-employee. You know, if that person wants X amount of dollars, they can ask for it. We don't know if they're telling us the truth. You know what I mean? As an employer, they could say they're getting $20 an hour. They might be getting 12. Who knows? So I think that, again, that's free enterprise. That's free exchange negotiation between the employer and the coworker. And that's, again, if you hire someone at a lower wage than really what they're worth, once they get on the job, they're not going to be long talking at the toolbox or going down to lunch with the coworkers saying, what, they're only paying you this? I'm making this. So, again, I think it's that people are naive that don't run businesses or manage businesses to know that when you have a population of coworkers, everybody knows everything, you know. So there is no, like, secret code of whatever conduct. I mean, it's pretty transparent.
The last one is criminal background check law. It basically has banned the box. It permits criminal history inquiry only after conditional offer of employment. In other words, you can't ask about on somebody, have you ever had a history or a criminal offense?
Yeah. Again, I'm trying to think of our own coworker employment application, because I don't know if those questions are on there. But I know we've hired people that have had a record. I know that because they've been open about it. You know, I think that trust is a big part of any relationship. I think we have to trust the fact that people applying for jobs are going to be, you know, forthright and straightforward. And I think within reason, we should be able to do some level of background check to confirm what they're telling us. You know, I think that's just fair because, you know, we take hiring serious. Believe me, we do. When we hire someone, it's for the long haul. So we want to know who we're getting on board. And you know what? They can do whatever they need to do. I want them to check on us, too, because it's a big commitment on their part.
Okay. Infrastructure. I'm going to specifically target just cell phone service at the moment because of the amount of time.
I love Terry Hayes' ads, too, by the way. I love her ads, don't you? Have you seen her ad on TV?
I have.
I love that ad because it is really so typical of what we go through.
It is. I mean, in downtown Portland, I drop calls.
Yeah.
Where does government play a role in that, or does it?
Well, I think government can play a role in terms of raising awareness and making it a priority to invite and solicit private investment, private enterprise. Say, look, we got a problem here. Which one of you carriers are going to step up and take care of it? Ultimately, it's the consumer, really, that benefits or doesn't from poor or good service. But, yeah, I think the government, as governor, I'll get Terry to be the spokesperson, you know, if I get in there. And if she's willing, she'd get it done.
No question. Okay, so two last questions. You talked about income tax, property taxes, employer taxes. What's your take on what should happen in the state of Maine since tax revenue is up significantly? Mm-hmm. Should it be given back? Should it be reused? What's your thoughts?
Well, this draws a real sharp contrast between, you know, all the other candidates and myself. I've been in all these forums and debates. We need a $100 million bond for this. I mean, I think Terry was talking about a $500 million bond to really build out broadband. And so I'm hearing a lot of these bonds for this and borrow for that. It's like, okay, look at what Governor LePage and the Republicans have done over the last 8 years. They've reduced our taxes. The economy's growing. Unemployment's the lowest it's been in decades. And some candidates are saying, let's go in a new direction. It's like, no, let's continue on the direction that we're on and build on what's already been established. Think back when he took over $750 million in hospital debt, had to get paid off. Imagine what we could have done with that money in terms of roads and bridges, broadband, cell phone service, whatever, where we could have put that money if we didn't have to pay our bills. So I am frightened that voters could just kind of let their guard down a little bit and say, oh, things are pretty good right now. Oh, let's try something different. Folks, seriously, you're going to have buyer's remorse if you don't do your homework on just look where you are right now. And you got to ask yourself, am I better off today than I was 8 years ago? And I don't think there's anyone in Maine that wouldn't say, heck yeah. And I look at a brighter future and let's stay the course, you know, with the Republican values of fiscal conservancy and business acumen. It's just proven, you know, proven track record. This has gotten Maine to where it is now and going forward. So, no, I'm excited to use all the skills, relationships, everything that I've done, in my private and personal life, bring all those forces to bear to help the Maine people.
Last question. Why should business leaders, HR professionals, vote for you as governor for the state of Maine?
Well, if you're talking about specifically that, you know, that population of people, I would just say this. We pioneered human resource before we even knew what it was. How did we do that? We introduced performance reviews on an annual basis back in 1992. That was 25 years ago. We quickly established open book management, where all of our coworkers see our revenue, our profit, our key performance indicators, our customer satisfaction index, all the key metrics they need to see day one. They could be 18-year-old apprentice sitting there. It's all open to them. I mean, the transparency that we have, employee ownership. So now 34% of our company is owned by our coworkers. Now think about how much of a trailblazer that we've been throughout our career. There's only about 45 employee-owned companies in the state out of 43,000. So when you think about, I think when we had a RESOP, we were one of only 20. So the philosophy and the business practices that we've employed in our small businesses over the years are just cutting edge. And it's hard for me to explain and say, oh, it runs a body shop. People don't have any idea the sophistication. We had the first software management system in the country back in 1995. You know, so we know how to drive data, how to drive outcomes, how to incentivize people, how to motivate people, how to inspire people. And that's what HR is all about, right? Because the greatest asset that we have are people.
Sean, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Dave.
This concludes today's special edition of the HR Power Radio Show. Go out and vote. I'm your host, David Chulope. It's been a pleasure speaking with Sean Moody. He is running for governor as a Republican candidate for the great state of Maine. His website is seanmoody.com, but you can, of course, go to hrpowerhour.com right after this show and listen to either the show again or connect directly with Sean and his team. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.